Hey, coming at you once again, like the meteor that got the dinosaurs. It's the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We're looking at the words, people. We're helping the good people beat the bad people with better words. That's kind of our game. I'm Dr. Dan, late night comedy writer, PhD in rhetoric, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The podcast does three things. We talk to comedians about their politics. I convert conservatives on this podcast because I'm fascinated by the right and afraid of them. And I talk to persuasion pros, especially rhetoricians, more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast in the world. That's my big claim. Today, we have a comedian, comedy writer. I know you're not conservative. I don't think you're a persuasion pro. So we're going to drop you right over into comedian. My guest today, provocateur. I wrote an intro for you. You ready?
Here we go.
Provocateur, small man with a big cigar, late night comedy writer with 4,000 Emmys on his shelf. Has 4,000 Emmys. He's won 4,000 Emmys.
It's a big shelf.
Sultan of Shock, one of the minions of the Dark Lords of comedy. Welcome, Dave. Did he just say that? Weiss.
What's up, America?
You're a pro. You've done comedy writing. You've done radio. We'll get into all this stuff. Did you ever do stand-up?
I did a little bit a couple years ago. I didn't enjoy it, really.
Really?
There's something about having other people screw up your jokes and have them die rather than standing up there and having it happen to you.
Well, you know, the game is for them not to die.
Yes, I know, but it was 3 years ago and I was pushing 80. And I just figured at a certain point, I don't want to be throwing my number in that fishbowl on top of the bar.
Yeah, buddy.
Then doing my act when the bar is full of nothing but friends of the comedians and the comedians who are going to sit on their hands.
It's
spot in the night.
It's an ugly landscape. And there's no trajectory in stand-up. Like, I remember years ago working with a guy down in Florida because all the old comics would still work down Florida. His name was Al April. I mean, almost straight at vaudeville. Mm-hmm. And just, he was probably in his 70s then and just working the rest homes. I'm like, oh, no, that's not the world I want.
No. I mean, you'd have permission to shoot me if you ever saw me doing that. I give you permission in front of the entire Rhetorician Warriors podcast to shoot me if you see me at the Shady Oaks entertaining a matinee.
I'm taking that permission. That's one of the things I'm going to put on my bucket list. Shoot Weiss if his life goes farther downhill.
Than it is now, yes.
Than it is now. So run your background a little bit. Tell everybody who Dave Weiss is. I mean, I kind of know you, but I don't really know that much about you. New York, baseball fan. What else?
Let's see. New York, baseball fan. I had like a short career in advertising and radio before I moved out to LA to do comedy.
Like Mad Men? Do you just like a Mad Men in New York?
A little taste of the Mad Men life.
Really?
But I like to say that advertising is show business without talent.
I completely agree. Like, I've rushed up against advertising and I was always like, man, you guys should hire some writers.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all like, oh, I have a screenplay.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a writer. I'm like, you're a writer.
Yeah. Dude, what do you think sounds funnier, 15 cents or 18 cents on the coupon?
Okay, so you had a little bit of that. You're originally, are you from the city, from New York?
No, I was raised on Long Island.
Long Island.
Notice how I did the pronunciation. But I went to the city fairly often. It's a bedroom community. So I consider myself a city boy.
Sure, I think you could pull that off. You've got that feel to you. Mets fan?
Yes. And I don't know why, and I don't know how. I only know that I bleed blue and orange.
Yeah, how did that happen? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know.
They squeaked through the big Yankee juggernaut?
Something like that. My brother's a Yankee fan, and I don't know how that happened either. But in terms of New York sports, you tend to be born into something because of your geographical location or your what your parents were. My father was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan, and then a lot of Brooklyn Dodger fans moved from Brooklyn to Nassau County or Suffolk County out on Long Island. And then when the Mets were born in 62, those people were already National League Baseball fans.
Okay.
So they naturally gravitated to the new Mets rather than become Yankee fans, because if you were a Dodger fan, you were not a Yankee fan. You hated the Yankees and you would have nothing to do with them, and neither would your children or your children's children.
And the regionality that they are able to infuse these teams with. It's like, I live right down the street from UT Austin, mm-hmm. You know, and 80,000 people in an ugly orange color making stupid hand gestures. There you go. It's just amazing the adherence that they can get with that stuff.
I know.
Like they've got you. The Mets have you. It was Tom Seaver, wasn't it? You fell in love.
He was one. He was
terrific
one.
Tom.
He's the first player I mean, 69 is the first year that I really remember the Mets. And, you know, granted, you know, that was the miracle year, the miracle Mets, when they won the World Series for the first time after 7 years of abject baseball futility. So.
Okay, cool. So we got a little bit of New York in. You got a little bit of baseball back there. Tell me about your writing progression. How did you get to become the...
Let's see. I started here. When I moved out here, I just moved. I had no job. I had no money. I had no car. I had no nothing. And I started doing crappy jobs at Fox in the tape vault.
Yeah, the tape vault.
This was before everything was digital. So there were giant master reels that you had to lug up and down the elevators so the editors could work, the masters. And I did that for a while, and that was miserable. Then
it's
I did-
vault. What do you want? They call it a vault. What's it gonna be?
Right, it was in the basement. It was a vault. And you had to do what people asked you to do. It was awful. I should have been fired for the way I treated people. But then after that, I had another job where it was the research company for CBS. They tested all the pilots in the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. They had barkers in front of the Grauman's Chinese Theater to bring in the tourists.
Okay, sure.
So they could get a representative sample of America. So I would sit in a room with these yahoos and I'd show them an episode of Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. And they had a red button and a green button. When you saw something you liked, you push red. Saw something, you know what I'm saying, other way
sure.
around. Then they had to fill out a questionnaire afterwards. And I would go around and I had to demographically classify them, which was, you know, so this was 25 years ago. You could still identify somebody by their ethnicity.
Yeah, it wasn't
not be sued for, right?
Yeah, sure.
But you know, they had to write little essays, you know, what they liked, sentences. I was amazed by how many Americans could not write sentences, because I had to read the things and go over them and enter them into the computer. And it was another horrible experience.
Yeah, when you open then, when you peel back the onion and see inside America's actual mind. Like, I remember my first year as a teaching assistant, the first time I ever read papers that were turned in at UT Austin when I was in grad school. And I was like, how did these people get to college? Like, this is, they right. take the top 10% at UT Austin. I'm like, this is the top 10% in Texas?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, like that. But then through my girlfriend's ex-boss, I heard about Dennis Miller Live. And
really, that's going to be your first job, Dennis Miller?
Well, wait. It doesn't start out with like walking off the street and walking into a writer's office.
Sure.
I started out as the receptionist because they needed a receptionist for 5 weeks. So my job needed a pretty bald face out front. And yeah. So my job was to get soup. I would call Erwan. You know Erwan on Beverly Boulevard?
Sure.
Okay. I would call them and I would type up, ooh, carrot leek and broccoli ginger today. And I would make a copy and I would circulate it to the staff. Then I would go to Erwan and pick up soup. And then they asked me back to be a writer's assistant and told me I could write jokes. So I wrote jokes. And, you know, I started getting jokes on the air. And then Dennis made me a writer.
So Dennis made you a writer?
Yeah. Yeah.
Eddie was the showrunner still at the time, right? Like,
yeah, but Dennis said yes, no, maybe. I mean, Eddie didn't have hire and fire power.
Okay. Interesting. So even like he wasn't that active when we worked together at CNBC. Dennis wasn't that active. He was no longer interested in.
Well, he wasn't that active. He was more active than he was at that point when you and I worked together. But I think that he likes, one of his strengths, I think, is that he had a healthy hands-off attitude when it came to the material, so that I never had the feeling that while I was writing, he was looking over my shoulder.
Right.
Never had that feeling. And there are a lot of shows where somebody's looking over your shoulder. He always respected the material, number one.
Yeah, and I, you know, that's one of the things I really liked about working for Dennis. Like, he was clearly a writer. He clearly appreciated the writers. He knew the good jokes. Like, he had really good radar for the good jokes.
Very good radar for that, exactly. And a lot of people don't. I've heard that Marr is not a good joke picker. And that's why his monologue sometimes gets
right
less than rave reviews.
But, yeah, I've been in, I guess, let's see, I started with Tom Arnold, and Tom Arnold actually had a good joke radar.
Good.
He could pick the best joke out of a bunch if you gave him the jokes. Mm-hmm. He couldn't come up with them, but he could definitely recognize them.
Okay. Well, that's a skill you need to have if you're a joke picker. Got to know how to pick jokes.
Joke picker. And then Kilbourne couldn't pick a joke to save his life.
No, he couldn't, but he was funny.
Could deliver a joke and had a sense of humor, but
he had no idea when he showed it to something. I mean, when I worked there, he had so little confidence in his own ability to pick jokes and material that he would sometimes bail on bits in the middle of the bit during taping and go to a commercial. And if I were in the booth would be like, holy shit, he just bailed out. We got to fill 7 minutes.
Yeah, that was an interesting job for Gibbons when I was there, because he had to support so much of the ligature that Kilbourne didn't have. Yeah. And again, look, Kilbourne was talented. He could do a lot of stuff really well. But his gaping, you know, comedy weaknesses like that, where he would not understand, you know, the full joke and would abandon all that. Like, I saw Gibbons kind of always right up there real close to him, making sure, you know, he could mitigate that as much as he possibly could. So it was a good match, those two guys.
Yeah, but I think Gibbons has had a very long career in this business. And I have to say, I don't know anything he ever wrote. I don't know one joke that Mike Gibbons ever wrote that was funny. So I'm not saying he's not talented. I'm not saying he's not a great guy, which I think he is, but I just don't think that he was a, you know, nose in your laptop, I'm going to crank out 50 jokes right now writer.
Yeah, I don't think that was him at all. Like, I never knew him. I only knew him for the year that I worked at Kilbourne with him, and he was really good at managing writers. He was good at managing the room. You know, again, he made people feel comfortable.
He could manage to the sides. And he can manage down. And when you can do that, you're a good manager.
Yeah, for sure.
I think he was that. But, you know, it's like if you or I wrote a monologue joke that crushed, it would stay in your mind for a long time.
Sure.
And I just don't have a memory like that with Gibbons. So.
Yeah, and their guys, I don't know, maybe it's I'm trying to think of percentage-wise, at least 50% of the people I knew as writers in Hollywood, we're not funny.
Yeah. Well, that's a prerequisite to be a Hollywood writer. Don't be funny.
I mean, some of them were clever. Like a lot of the a lot of the East Coast guys, the Harvard guys and stuff like that were clever, but you couldn't put any of that stuff on stage and get a laugh with it in a club.
No, no. See, and sometimes those guys have gone on to bigger and better things. And I keep saying to myself, I know he wasn't funny, you know, and I don't get it, but.
Well, there's enough funny people around you in almost every show that you can always siphon off the you know, actual talent that you need. Yeah. You don't need that much to run a show, like that much comedy.
I guess you can be funny adjacent to be very successful.
Yeah, apparently. So take me back to Dennis Miller Live. Talk about that show for, us through it. You started out, like, what year? Well, like, the first year?
It's of the show? No, like the second or the third.
Okay.
I think. And I worked there for probably four seasons. And it's, you know, I don't know if you saw this. CNN is doing their story of late night this week.
No, I didn't see.
Okay. They're doing another one of those limited series, you know, oh, we're going to take you behind the scenes of late night.
Right.
And it's like, sure, I could do that for you in about 20 minutes. You know, there's, look over there. See that room of people with laptops sweating? That's late night.
Right.
You know, and so they have, you know, they're interviewing all, and I'm getting off track. My point was that they shouldn't be doing a review of late night of the you know, 80s and 90s, the Letterman Leno wars, all that kind of stuff, without Dennis Miller in it.
Right. Yeah.
And knowing Dennis, they probably asked him and he said no. But you know, for all the rhetoricians out there, we did, our show was wall-to-wall jokes.
Wall-to-wall. Like
wall-to-wall.
From the first word to the last, it was just getting the good jokes right out into the world.
Right, right. And it was half an hour, and you walked out of there breathless from laughing.
Well, you had, what, 6-7 writers?
Yeah, we had 6-7 writers. We did one show a week, so...
Half hour. That, yeah, yeah, that's going to sing. Yeah.
Oh, it was every week. You know, a bad show would still have some huge laughs. You know, either from Dennis just digging out of a bad joke or something that you didn't think was going to work that worked, or the other way around. You know, it was live. And, you know, live plus a week of writing, distilled down. I mean, that's going to kill. If it doesn't kill every week, there's something wrong with your writer's room.
Right. To me, that show had the best production process ever. Like you said, it's got great, it had a great writing staff. Dennis had all the live chops from stand up. Mm-hmm. He also had on camera chops. The guy could handle two camera work.
He loves the prompter.
You know?
He loves it.
And I watched that. I've seen so many stand-ups who fail at that juncture, who cannot go to prompter and bring that sort of energy that prompter, you know, demands in order to make it work.
Yeah. People probably thought, if you hadn't watched the show before, that he's not using a prompter. And meanwhile, the prompter was like, you know, it was like that big in the middle of the stage.
That's funny.
Again, listen.
So who else was on staff there? Hannah was there, right?
Jim Hannah was there. Let's see, David Feldman, Eddie Feldman, Leah Krinsky, Jose Arroyo, who I am still in touch with.
Jacob, I never met Bunch him. That's one of those guys I never crossed paths with.
He went on to do Mar for a little bit, and now he's still on Conan. He's stayed with Conan till the bitter end.
And that has been the longest job in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, but hey, you know, I would, if you had told me now that I could have spent 20 years on Conan instead of scuffling and scrambling and, you know, and writing monologue jokes by myself, okay.
Yeah, for sure. And it seems like a very humane place. Kylie seems like he runs probably a good ship and everybody seems happy there.
Yeah, Kylie, that guy, Brian Stack. I think. Know. He never did Conan?
I don't know him.
Okay. I thought you knew the name. Okay. Never mind.
I know Laura Kilmartin was there. I don't know if she's still there or not.
She's still there.
Yeah. So talk about the process there a little bit, with the Dennis Miller writing.
The process was unusual and unique among all the late night shows because, number one, we were only going once a week. Number two, as we just covered, we wrote an enormous amount of material. He would write monologue jokes. And for a monologue on the show live at Friday at 5:30, 10 jokes. So myself, I would probably write 50 per week. So we're talking about 350 to 400 monologue jokes generated per week, distilled down to 10. It's going, like you said, it's going to sing.
Yeah, there's not going to be any gold jokes.
There's
in
gold
that.
In there. Just gotta tap it out of the comedy ore. There it is. Just chisel around there. And then we wrote his rant, where we would each write. I was looking at some crap I wrote, and it's all crap, but I was looking at some crap I wrote about coaches, you know, a rant about coaches. And a line that I think he used was, you know, I want to give a shout out to my man, Coach Burry, who was always coaching me on strength and flexibility. And it was only until college that I learned baseball had other positions besides pitcher and catcher. So we would all write a rant like that. And again, you know, 6-7 people doing it, plus Dennis, we distill it down into a page and a half of comedy. And then we all did picture captions, which were, we had an account with the AP, the Associated Press. They would send us 30 black and white press pictures a day. You know, the topical, what's going on in the world that week. Some of them were just weird. They had no topic whatsoever. You know, a picture of a fish, whatever. And, you know, you captioned those to the best of your ability. So we were doing, so like if you're Dennis, you're sitting at home and you get a picture of, you know, of Biden today, you know, and he's wearing his shades and he's got the dog. So Dennis would have 15 captions on that to choose from. And then, you know, these were the same process as the monologue, where we'd condense it all down on show day from 100 down to about 25. And some of them would die that you didn't expect to die. And some of them would kill in a fashion that, you know, they would cut back to a one shot of Dennis, you know, to have him baste himself in the admiration, the applause, and the hilarity.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting when you think about what the production process itself does to either kill the yield or ensure the yield's going to be amazing. And people don't really get this outside of professional comedy writing.
I think a lot of people in professional comedy writing don't understand it, because there's, for me, I mean, I've written both, you know, dramatic, comedic, plus late night variety. There's a purity in the product, I think, that comes from people working monk-like, you know, like
by yourself,
illuminating that Bible manuscript and then bringing it all together, rather than 7 people sitting in a room trying to come up with the best Bill Gates divorce joke.
Yeah, I hated that process. I hate group writing.
That's just my experience. I find
the group process like that. Maybe later on, when you're polishing, you're trying to beat jokes and things like that, you want that kind of verbal energy.
That's a group setting right before a show. You know, when you've got something amorphous and you're looking to, you know, to put the edges on it and all the finishing touches. But to generate the product, I prefer if everybody is just looking at a blinking cursor.
It is the trolls in the mountain. I had, you know, Chuck Hallis on here a few weeks ago. And
sure, you know, he knows what I'm talking about. Yeah, yeah. I was with him at Kilbourne.
Okay. And, you know, he was the ultimate troll in his office. Like, I never heard the guy say a funny word in the room, but you send him back to his office and he comes out with the four sharpest jokes in the show.
Yeah.
And if you don't know that, if you don't know how to work with that kind of talent, you know, with the different ways that talent works and cobble it together into a staff, then you miss all those isotopes that you get if you really do understand these people and the way that they create.
Well, when you put product first before people and their interests and their politics, then for me, you know, comedically, entertainment wise, that's where you get the best work. I mean, we've all, there's a phrase in Hollywood called, it's said like being noted to death.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, like we could, even on our show, we would get notes from HBO every once in a while. Oh, we thought this might have been funnier this way, might have been funnier that way. And we would all pretty much just go fuck yourself. I spent all week in a room by myself with the lights off writing jokes.
Yeah, when I was at Best Dance Sports Show, they had originally, when they launched that show, it was supposed to be half comedy, half sports. So they had a comedy EP and a sports EP, and they co-produced the show. And so the comedy guy did all the comedy bits and sketches and jokes and everything else. But then they decided, like Fox does, to come in and just start cutting budgets. So they got rid of the comedy EP, and the sports EP took it over. And so we now had to run jokes past him. This guy had no sense of humor whatsoever.
Of course.
He would line item our jokes. He'd be like, not that one, not that one. Nah, you know, work on like what? And I said to him once, like, you have six professional comedy writers here. Why don't you let them choose? And he's like, this is my show. I'm like, I get it, dude, but come on.
All right. Come on. Well, that's the prime example of what happens when something is choking off the comedy flow. And, you know, granted, the Best Damn Sports Show isn't around anymore.
Well, they killed it. It was super successful.
Well, they killed it, right. They killed it by putting that guy in charge.
It went to 2 hours a day, 5 days a week at one point. It was so popular.
Yeah, I remember.
They're like, oh, yeah, now we got to cut the budget. I'm like, you got to do what?
There is no budget. There's no production.
It's a cable show anyway. I was getting like $800 a week. It was crazy.
Not even Guild.
Yeah, it wasn't even Guild. So talk about this. Like, you are famous for having, you know, writing the dark side of comedy. I introduced you this way. I think David Feldman gets some of this too, right? Has a darkness in his writing.
Yes.
There's a certain layer of comedy writers that's their go-to. That's what sings to them the most is the punch.
I have found that when I'm, in fact, I was reviewing a lot of my jokes this morning for another Texas podcast with bald people that I do. And
they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And I have to go through my jokes and say, okay, this one will work. It's not my favorite, but the bulk of people will understand this joke and it's funny. Then I'll come to another joke, say, I love this joke. Dan loves this joke. Nobody else will get it. And it's just, you got to delete it as much as you love it.
It hurts though.
And then there are jokes that are, right, it hurts like hell that people won't get it because it's too dirty, too mean, too dark, too racist. You know, if you took a random sampling of Dennis Miller Live shows right now and looked at them, I would say 50% of those jokes would not make it onto the air today.
Yeah, it's a complete
because of the subject matter.
Yeah,
and
it's a different reception environment in it, and you can write to anything. You know this as well as I do. If you're a professional comedy writer, a professional writer, you can adjust to whatever rules they give you.
You have to.
But your core, the best stuff you're going to write is in your core. It's what your natural voice does. And
that's
so we're
right.
Literally killing our best comedy all the time.
Exactly. Well, the one thing I discovered on my own was that the hit rate when you're writing monologue jokes is 10%. Every 10 jokes that you write, there's one that is
doable
and funny, and that one's a keeper. The rest, for whatever reason, they have to go in the garbage. And you know, and what's great about writing on your own, one thing great is that everything is saved. You know, so then I can go myself to my jokes and say, okay, you know, like I wrote a bunch of Willie Nelson jokes the other day for his birthday. And
hit me with a few. Let's hear some of the Willie Nelson jokes.
Let's see. Well, it's Willie Nelson's 88th birthday today. You know what you get when you subtract 420 from 88? Neither does Willie. Let's get high.
Hey.
So.
Yeah, you know, and it's.
You know, it might work because people know Willie Nelson's a pothead. But if you don't know Willie Nelson's a pothead, which is a possibility, like my mom doesn't know Willie Nelson's a pothead. So, you know, you lose audience that way. And as much as it kills you because it's a halfway decent joke, if they're not with you on the setup, they won't be with you on the punchline.
Yeah, and there is that whole thing about you have to please the audience. It's entertainment, you know, it's not art. So you're not supposed to just be self-indulgent and obscure. But I will say this, and I've had this argument in a few different ways with people for 30 or 40 years now. Like, first of all, comedy theoretically has no moral center. Like, its only purpose is to get laughs. So you can't import outside moral issues into comedy.
No, you can't.
And people do. They can't stop themselves.
That's right.
So you can't use that stuff to judge it. Like, I have people every once in a while like, oh, you shouldn't have said that joke. I'm like, did you laugh? I'm like, no. Well, then just don't laugh. I don't need to hear anything else.
Right. I don't need your editorial comments. It is funny or it's not funny. I don't want notes from you.
No, exactly.
I'll write more jokes.
I mean, I write probably 2,000, 2,500 jokes a year on social media. I just, to entertain myself, I collect them in my own stuff, and then I put them out there. And somebody will read it for months and not say a word. Then I'll say a joke they don't like, and then they decide that that's when they have to speak. I'm like, well, what about the 2,000 other jokes that you read?
Right. I did a couple of weeks ago. This is a great example of that. Stephen Colbert had posted on Twitter a lame joke about something. I think it was a COVID joke. And it pissed me off because, first of all, the joke was lame. Second of all, they put it up on Twitter like it wasn't lame.
Right.
Three, it's Stephen Colbert. They have to know that that's a lame joke before it goes through three levels of managers and gets to the air. And I pretty much did all that in my little tweet. You know, hit send, you know, 11:30, I might have smoked a joint. I don't know. I don't know if anything like that was going on. So, but I got so much angry responses from it. It was just a joke.
From just like people commenting?
Yeah, people, regular people, America. Not comedians.
That's why on all my stuff, I don't open up comment channels. I do not want to hear anybody respond to anything I say. Okay. Because then they'll be in my head. And then I have to start worrying about crafting the jokes. And I'm not getting paid to do this.
No.
I know how to walk, you know, the fine line. And I know how to make myself seem moral and all that. Yeah. But really, if you're just defending the comedy art, I want to hear the worst thing that Dave Weiss thinks.
Well, I'll have to email that you privately.
Anytime the writer's room stuff leaks out into the real world, right? I used to have Oshak and I were great at, you know, hitting each other back and forth with horrific jokes. And I'm like, if any of this ever drifted into the real world without the comedy confines around it, we'd be hung. Canceled. We'd be killed. Canceled.
And I think about this from time to time. You know, when I'm writing and I'm explaining, or I'm out in the dating world, Dan.
I am.
I'm going to be very circumspect when I say this. But when I'm explaining to people what I do and how how jokes are written, they're always amazed. And I think to myself, you know, I have no other marketable skills, which is a problem. If I wasn't funny, I'd probably be homeless. I never wanted to do anything else but be a Hollywood comedy writer. You know, I'm glad that, you know, I'm not 58 and bitter and twisted. I mean, I'm bitter and twisted, but for other reasons.
But it wasn't
for good reasons.
You came in bitter and twisted.
I came into this world bitter and twisted. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad.
So take this idea, like, so we're now talking here, like we've had both had careers writing, and I probably never really wrote dark for a living. Like I'm pretty comfortable in the middle. Like I can write clever. That's my sort of idiom that I always made a living with, is just clever. I love writing dark, and I've sold dark to comics and stuff forever. I would love to be able to do it, but I could never make it work on stage. Something about bald white guy looks like me, this comes off too rough.
Yeah, see, I can make it work.
Well, you're more cuddly than me. Look at you.
Yeah, I'm cuddly. See that, ladies? I'm cuddly.
The dark, cuddly Dave
White. The dark, cuddly prince.
But I always enjoyed it, and I really love those kind of writers, and I've had some really favorite writers and comedians over the years who do dark stuff and work those areas. And I think Dennis was an interesting example of somebody who, you know, for years have worked the intellectual side of things, but had the kind of cover of being the liberal prince, right? Mm-hmm. When you lose that political cover and that social cover and you move over to the right and you start doing dark stuff or write on, you know, the money harsh jokes, man, there's no cover at all.
No, the cover gets yanked off you pretty quickly. And there's a reason there's almost no such thing as a conservative comedian. You know, we could spend another 2 hours on it, you know, and how it's just not funny, you know, when you're, you know, that punching down, punching up. I'm not a huge proponent of that. I think funny is funny. And, you know, there's a certain, you can't be too mean, but you got to be able to take a joke.
Yeah.
In the manner of which it is presented, especially if you're a public figure. I mean, we're not going to make, you know, certain demographic groups are off limits. I never write jokes about children. Children are innocent until they're adults and in charge of their own destinies, they get a pass. I never wrote a Chelsea Clinton joke. I refuse to write Barron Trump jokes, even though, you know, there's a lot of Barron Trump jokes to be written.
Yeah, you could do those jokes.
But he doesn't, you know, he doesn't deserve it. He was born into it. He doesn't deserve it.
Right. So you have some standards for who can't be.
I have some standards for who gets a pass. Not many.
When I tell people, like when they find out, you know, that I wrote for Dennis Miller, everybody wants to assign your politics to the person that you work for.
Yes.
I'm like, yeah, you know, I also worked for Tom Arnold and I wasn't an idiot, and I worked for Kilborn. I wasn't a frat boy.
Yeah.
So you tell me, like I always tell people, like Dennis assigned politics, political angles himself. The writers didn't do that. Most of those writers were all liberals.
Yeah. The one direction that he gave us was don't do Bush jokes because I'm not going to tell them. So yeah. I didn't write any George Bush jokes. So, okay, fine.
Yeah, everybody has limits. Like when I was at Best Damn, the producer was best friends with Pete Rose. So he wouldn't do Pete Rose jokes.
That's unfortunate. There's a lot of good
people. Right? Like this was when Pete Rose came out. And
I bet Pete Rose would have loved them.
Yeah. So there's always restrictions like that, right? So
yeah, always. But again, you don't want restrictions that choke off the comedy. Because there's one, you know, if one joke that's gold doesn't make it to air, that's somebody's fault. Because that's a huge laugh that didn't happen because somebody didn't know what was going on. They made the wrong decision. And you got to, I like to put people in positions to succeed, not in position to fail.
Well, talk about when you moved over to being Dennis's sidekick, like on air. Cause I remember
on
that
the radio.
Yeah. Cause somebody told me that that was happening. And I'm like, what? I said, that's an odd pairing, which sometimes is great. I mean, odd pairing is great. But I never saw you as a sidekick type. You're more like the guy in the back whispering horrible shit.
Well, the way that happened was I had gone out for pancakes with my son. I came back to the house and my wife at the time hands me the phone and says, it's Dennis. I said, what? Dennis, okay. Hello, Dennis. And he said, I got this radio show. I wanted to know if you wanted to be my sidekick. Yes.
Sure. Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. It took about 15 seconds. And so we did some, some pre-work about what the format of the show was going to be and what my role was going to be as the co-host / liberal counterpart to his right-wing leanings. And it worked for about 3 years. And the problem was the sponsors did not want me on the air. Because
really?
Yeah. He was getting shit from Sinclair Broadcasting, who were, they owned a shitload of radio stations.
Yeah, for sure.
And if there's a great New Yorker article about the evil of Sinclair Broadcasting, if anybody wants to, comb the archives of the New Yorker and read it. But they got me fired. And
interesting.
Yeah, you didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
I also didn't know you were set as sort of a liberal counterpart. So you guys had actual discussions on air about...
We had discussions, but we did not have arguments. We looked for the comedy in everything. And if you listened to the show, there was not... We didn't start out the day by like rustling the New York Times... Dennis wasn't like, well, Sal, what do you think about the $1.8 trillion plan? Yeah, we didn't do that. We talked about soup.
Okay.
And then we talked about politics.
Sure.
It wasn't it wasn't the McLaughlin group by any means.
Did you like that gig? Is that something that you would like to continue to do?
Loved that gig. I mean, what's not to love? You get up, you take a shower. You go to the office, you talk for a couple of hours, you go home. There's no meetings. There's no, you don't have to talk to anybody. Dennis and I were never even in the same studio. He had a studio in his house in Santa Barbara. So we worked together for 3 years. I saw him once.
Do you want to hear my favorite Dennis story? I don't know if you remember this or not. When we were at CNBC, we double tape on Tuesday, Thursdays. So he came in from Santa Barbara and would be there for those 2 days. And I remember in between breaks, in between the two shows, like we would bus audiences in and he came back for the second rehearsal all ticked off about something. And I don't remember who it was that asked him what the problem was or what was going on. He's like, because I was just out back, I used to be the cultural zeitgeist of this country. Like the comedy zeitgeist, I had my finger right up it and somebody just came up to me and was like, hey man. And I thought they're going to ask for an autograph. And they said, where do we get paid? Where do we get paid for sitting in your audience? And he's like, I got to get back. This is killing me.
That's a good one. Yeah, but that's an inside dark seamy side of Hollywood type thing. For example, I was one of my first gigs was I co-wrote with my ex-wife a Grace Under Fire script. She was working on the program and they, we nudged them and nudged them and nudged them and they let us write a script. So we were invited to Brett Butler's.
That was a good show for a while. Brett Butler was good.
Yeah, we were invited to her house for a holiday party. And Joan had been telling me stories up until then about just how unhinged she really was. Even and but she was still controllable.
Right.
It wasn't okay. So we walk, you know, we drive up into the Hollywood Hills, up Woodrow Wilson Drive, you know, and it gets quieter and quieter and quieter. And so, you know, we pull up to the big house and, you know, they look at you, the buzzes in. You know, we park, walk up into the house, and, you know, and the doors are open, party's going on. And my wife is a few steps ahead of me, and lo and behold, Brett is right in the doorway. And, oh, Brett, I'd like you to meet somebody. This is my husband, David. And instead of saying hello, she flashes me. I swear. She had just gotten new texts and she needed me to see them.
Wow. That's solid. That is good Hollywood.
It happened. It happened.
That is
and
good.
I could not unsee them.
Well, the way I met Dennis, I was talking to some of the writers in the hallway on the first day, and I was standing there, and I got somebody punched me in the back, and I turned around. It was Dennis.
Yeah.
And he's like, "You're the new writer." I'm like, "I better be, otherwise I'm going to kick your ass."
Yeah. Oh, I can't do that now, Dan.
Can't do it. Hollywood is restrictive, which is weird. You think the whole comedy thing and the creative thing would give people license, but it also gives license to import, you know, a lot of oppressed groups and a lot of underrepresented groups and things like that, which imports all the politics of it. It's so hard to do comedy on eggshells and avoid the political transgression.
It can't be done. If you told me right now to assemble a writing staff and put on a show today at 5:30, it's 1:45, I could do it. But it wouldn't be the writing staff that would reflect the woke consciousness of the United States of America.
For sure. But
I'm saying, you know, who gets, you know, in a lineup of writers, and Dennis was really good about this. He insisted that Eddie take the names off of every package. So he didn't know who had written the jokes. He would just say package A, package B, package G. So he never could be accused of playing favorites or catering to woke sympathies. He only picked the funniest stuff.
It is an odd issue though. Like, cause I know when I watch shows that have been written predominantly by female writers, I can tell, you know, I can tell the jokes are different. I can tell that most of the, even in narrative, I can usually tell if it's been directed by a woman writer versus, you know, sort of a traditional male, white male director. Not that one's better or worse than the other, but it has a different feel. The instincts are different. The timing's different. And that's not always just gender, but it goes across. Like, I taught screenwriting at UT Austin for a while, and I had a lot of people come from other cultures and try to write American screenplays.
A kid
who had grown up in India and he had decent English skills, but he did not have the story structures that work in America.
And his sense of humor completely off.
It's all different. And I'm like, I should fail you. I mean, because you're taking a mainstream American screenwriting course and you're not hitting any of the beats. You're not hitting any of the notes correct.
Right.
So I gave him a C, and then he got really upset that he got a C
and he sued
the dean. So I sympathize with it. I came from working class, like Kentucky, which is not, like, most people in Hollywood are not working class Kentucky. I can tell you that.
No, that's true.
So I was on staffs with guys from the East Coast constantly.
Yeah.
I've worked enough in that culture, and I didn't always feel conversationally simpatico, but comedy was simpatico, so it was fine.
If everybody speaks the same comedy language, that's okay. Chances are, I mean, when, let's see, on the Dennis Miller writing staff, 1, 2, 3 New Yorkers, Eddie upstate New York, you know, you were from Kentucky, Oshak was from Memphis, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember where some of the other guys were from, but it was not a New York East Coast heavy writing staff, I don't think.
Well, it was about half. That's what you're about saying. Half. Like, and yeah, it, often it's 80% or more.
It could have used some more women, I think. I think.
Yeah, my favorite comedians, I mean, are female. Like, there's something about female sense of humor when they...
Well, is it just... No, go ahead.
Like Maria Bamford, you know, some of the people that just do really, they have just an odd mind that I can't predict. I just enjoy the fact that I cannot predict the comedy that's coming.
So, okay. But you follow stand-up a lot more heavily than I do. So when it comes to female stand-ups, I think I probably like more of the more prominent ones. I like Sarah Silverman. I like Margaret Cho. They consistently make me laugh. But when if someone comes out and says, "Hey, what's up, party people?" I'm out.
Well, it's not talking to me. I'm not party people.
Yeah, right. I'm out.
Have you run into any backlash from being associated with Dennis, like trying to get work? Do people think you're a right winger?
I haven't run across it face to face, but I do think that it has affected things because, you know, my best work and my Emmy come from Dennis Miller.
Sure.
And no one wants to hear, "Well, I worked for Dennis Miller, but my politics aren't like Dennis Miller. I'm actually a nice, funny, liberal guy."
Huh.
Hey. And, you know, that just falls by the wayside because people who have the power to hire you are often ignorant.
What? Executives? What? Executives,
right. And they'll see something that they don't like and they just, you know, put your material in the shredder.
Well, anything that disqualifies you, any DQ at all, they'll use because there's usually so many people applying for things that they're just looking for ways to shear it down.
They also know deep down that they know nothing about picking good writing or picking funny writing. So the only way that they can look important and look busy and look relevant is to make decisions based on improper input, so to speak. Does that make sense?
No, I totally get it. And
you know, like they're adding shit to shit and expecting they're going to get a gold egg, and it's you know, the equation doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and issues of competence are everywhere in every industry, and comedy is particularly frustrating because as you get older, like when you talk about demographics and the way different demographics are taught or treated, the older demographic, like being an old white guy right now, where are you going to work?
You might as well be dead.
And I've seen this across many different guys that I came up with, and I know they're talented. And I get it. Like, it's a young person's game in a lot of ways. Everybody's got things working against them. But this one, man, I just don't know. Like, that's one of the reasons why I'm not interested in trying to get work in Hollywood again.
Yeah, no, it's different right now. I ran into an old friend who has a pilot, and I'm going to be submitting for his pilot. And I'm just glad that I know him, because if I was just submitting regularly, my stuff would go into the old white guy pile. You know, this way my stuff is going right to somebody who knows me and is not going to disqualify me based on, you know, the color of my head.
It's a bald thing. They're against all the bald.
Bald thing, right, yeah.
So what do you got? Like, give me some of the jokes that you've written lately that you like.
Okay, let me.
That you were going through. Let's call a little.
Notebook.
Give people a little bit of the taste of the Weiss. The Edelweiss.
Hold on a second. Well, that's just Linus is a bigger loser than Charlie Brown.
Why do you say that? Let's explore Linus.
Linus is a bigger loser than Charlie Brown. Well, first of all, he still carries a blankie.
He does carry a blankie.
Yeah, he carries a blankie. You know, and Charlie Brown has dreams.
He's trying to get somewhere.
He's trying to get somewhere. He's trying to pitch. He's trying to kick the football. He's trying to date the little red-haired girl. What the fuck is Linus doing? He's carrying a blanket and giving everybody directions.
Given
life, Linus.
Preaching. He's a blanket.
Waiting for the great pumpkin.
Last time I went on stage doing stand up, I hate doing material anymore. It's so much more fun to just walk up and just start whatever. But I usually think of something that week, and that week was I noticed that Winnie the Pooh didn't have fingers.
Didn't have pants either.
And I'm like, but I walked up and was like, so what? Hey, what happened to Winnie the Pooh's fingers? Like, he's got a thumb and an oven mitt. What happened to that thing's fingers? And people were just like, so I made them theorize about it for 20 minutes.
I always wonder what happened to Whoopi Goldberg's eyebrows. Every once in a while, put on The View and notice that Whoopi has no eyebrows.
Really?
Really, honestly and truly. She doesn't even bother to draw them on. She just doesn't have any.
I remember when Carrot Top walked into the Hollywood Improv one night and he had gotten the tattooed on eyebrows for Vegas, you know, super big and super dark so they could see him from the cheap seats. And I've known him forever. And I'm like, hey, Scott, who let Lauren Bacall in the door? He's like, fuck you, man.
Lauren Bacall. Oh, that's a good one.
What else you got? Linus. Yeah, Linus is a jerk. He's a preachy jerk.
He's a preachy jerk.
Everybody's a jerk. Here's something. Charlie Brown.
Where is it? Where is it? Oh, I'm 58, Dan. A threesome for me is having porn on two screens.
I like the fact that if you're a heavy Christian and God's always with you, you're always in a threesome.
Hey, I like that one. Oh, by the way, Jesus is not coming back. You know why? Because every time he does come back, we just kill him again.
Right? It seems like a pretty straight up agreement.
Yeah.
He
doesn't want to come back. And if he does come back, I'm not teaching him how to drive.
There's so many. If Jesus had just pulled out a cell phone or just a piece of pizza or something that showed that he had some type of actual supernaturalism to him. Like if it just suddenly said iPhone in the Bible.
Yeah, right. That would make it a lot easier to believe. I also love when you compare, you know, there are parts of the Bible that are, you know, in...
No, you froze.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we were gone. Now we're back. So you're about to decimate the Bible for everybody.
Oh, yeah, the Bible. My take on the Queen's Gambit, Dan. Knight to overrated and soon forgotten.
There should be a bit somehow, right, in like a publishing house giving notes on the early versions of the Bible.
Yeah.
Like, don't like the ending.
That's a good bit.
Yeah, that would be a good
bit. We're not really happy with the ending. Is there some way that Jesus could live?
We'd like this Pontius Pilate, like somebody to take him out. Like, we're getting no catharsis here whatsoever. What's your take on Biden?
I happen to like Biden. I don't think he's a genius by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that he's exactly what America needs at the moment, which is just a big, absorbent tourniquet
that's funny.
On the gaping wound that is, you know, that is this country right now. And once all the blood is soaked up and the bleeding stops, then they can wash off the wound and see what we've got. You know, and that may be 4 to 10 years from now. But, you know, that's the way it has to be.
Do you have any theory on any of that stuff? Like, I do converting conservatives, and I sort of have rhetorical apparatus for helping that happen. But what do you have from the twisted mind of Dave Weiss about?
Well, right now, I mean, there's conservatives and then there's Trumpers. And I think that today, I was reading before that Kevin McCarthy is looking for a way to get rid of Liz Cheney because she's not a Trumper. And that is going to lead, I think, that might be the first domino in the real splitting of the Republican Party into traditional Republican values, you know, conservative, small government, whatever else they stand for. And
unfun, lack of fun.
Yeah, lack of fun and wearing ties on Sunday.
That's the worst thing for me. I tell everybody when I do the podcast, when I have conservatives on, like my allegiances are to comedy. Like I want the person that's funniest to be president.
Right.
And conservatives are never funny. They're never fun. It's never any fun to hang out with them.
No. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's not as if living in the bubble that I live in and the bubble that you probably live in, that there's a group of conservatives at the bar like, hey, come on over. We want a liberal perspective on things. You know, that kind of doesn't happen anymore these days, except I'm going to Vegas in a couple of weeks, you know, for a vacation. I happen to like the Vegas. And it's one place where people do mix, where, you know, there is no, you know, granted, if you're wearing a shirt that says Proud American and the shirt's cut off over here, you've got a big flaming cross on your arm, I might not want to, you know, buy you a drink, but there's a certain camaraderie in the desert.
That's funny. Well, everybody's losing their money together, right?
Right. Losing their money. It's hot. How's the pool? Do you have a cocktail? Did you take a nap? You know, things that
everybody can
deal with. Vacation things.
I think they should. It's interesting that that word is so close. Like one arm should be Proud American. The other should be Pride American.
Ooh.
Completely different. And
write that down, Dan, or else
same word. Same word.
Yeah, how come you never see any Chinese people with the American word for pride down their arm? What's up with that, Dan?
That is a good question. Other than the fact that, you know, letters are ugly. I guess calligraphy, they try to pretty them up, but.
Yes. That's a freebie for everybody out there. It's my Chinese tattoo joke.
Do you have favorite jokes that you remember from the years? Like hit us with one of the favorites that you threw on to Dennis Miller.
Big Blue beat like Garry Kasparov in chess. This was, you know, when the computer came out, and the joke was, in a gesture of mourning, chess fans around the world use black tape to hold their glasses together.
That's it. Go after the chess. Hard jab to the chess community. There was,
when Gene Rayburn passed away. I love this joke. Match game host Gene Rayburn has passed away. The funeral went very well, except for that moment when Charles Nelson Reilly blanked into the open grave.
That is a good, that's a good 70s joke right there. Like if you live through the 70s.
That's right.
That encapsulated a lot of
the 70s.
A lot of it.
And you watched a lot of game shows like I did, you might get that joke.
Well, cool, man. I think we're at an hour. You managed to not say anything, I think, to sink your dating chances out there. So that's,
yeah,
that was the real goal here, right?
Yeah, they're listening. Not they.
Not she. They. She.
She.
She, the one. The, yeah, one. The one.
I can't mention any names.
I got you. Well, I appreciate it, man. It was super fun.
Super fun, Daniel.
Always stuff to talk about in the Weiss world. And any last thoughts? Can people find you? Are you promoting yourself?
Yeah, you can find me on the Twitter at D Weiss Comedy. Follow me. If you get the jokes, that's great. If you don't, that's great too.
Yeah, like I said, I'm all, if you want to hit me with something positive, I'll listen. If anything's negative, you're going to get blocked before I even finish the sentence. So just let you know. It's all good. Well, super fun. I appreciate it, Dave. We'll circle back at some point. This is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, comedy, politics, rhetoric. Get out there and persuade some people. They, as usual, need it. We'll see you next time.